From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The armistice declaring the end of World War I on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month was signed 100 years ago. Well, we are remembering that monumental day and all the sacrifices of war before or since as we observe Veterans Day. More than 100,000 men and women from Georgia contributed to the World War I effort, and the Georgia World War I Centennial Commission has organized remembrances throughout the year. Laura McCarty is president of Georgia Humanities, and she's here to tell us a little bit about the legacy and what's going on to celebrate. Laura, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
I appreciate your time. Now, Laura, you spent much of your time researching World War I in the lead-up to the centennial of the armistice. So can you take us back around that time, before the war? What was life like for Georgians in the early 20th century?
In the early 20th century, Georgia was primarily an agrarian economy. And because of that, when World War I began in Europe, there was a reluctance for America to get involved. There was concern about crops not being able to be traded with countries in Europe. And also, there was concern about labor, which was needed to work in the fields back home. So it took international intrigue and lots of publicity about them to have that attitude change. And in 1917, when America did declare war, the attitude became very in favor of assisting in the war effort quickly.
Mm-hmm. So initially resistant. And of course, you know, a war not that long before that in everybody's recent memory. But now Georgia was home to more World War I training camps than any other state. So what happened? What was the mobilization effort like here in Georgia?
Well, Georgia has always been a transportation hub. We've had railroads and interaction through our ports on the coast. And Fort McPherson was one of the training facilities that was already existent at the time that the war began. But many other communities began to see the opportunity. You could even call it the economic development opportunity of hosting training camps. We have Fort Gordon over in Augusta right now. But during World War I, we had Camp Gordon in Chambly, and that was really one of the major training installations during the war. Up in northwest Georgia, Fort Oglethorpe, there was a training institution that was for the cavalry.
When were these built and why?
Well, they were very quickly built as they began to see people called up and needing to be trained to go abroad. Mm-hmm. Some of them were already here and others of them were established. Fort Benning is also having their centennial this year. And it clearly was the people of Columbus saying to the government, look at our great community and the land that we have available and the personnel that we have available. And so that was the beginning of that institution in Georgia.
Laura, one of Georgia's most decorated World War I heroes, a man named Eugene Jack Bullard. Can you tell us about his story?
Well, he's also tied into Columbus. He, African-American gentleman born in Columbus, and after an unfortunate racial incident with his father, he left Georgia. That was a trend that was underway in Georgia and the South, African-Americans that could get into opportunities with industry or other things in the North, or in his case, in Europe, did so. So he ended up stowing up on a ship and going to Europe, connected up with the French Army, and actually had the opportunity to become an aviator. And his medals and things were won for his service in that capacity. He's remembered as the world's first African-American combat aviator, a Georgia native. After World War I, he had a nightclub in Paris, and some Germans were in there, and he ended up having to be stowed away out of France because of that.
It was supposed to be the war that ended all wars. Well, certainly it didn't, but it ended and changed so many things in American culture and also here in Georgia. We're talking about World War I. It is the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I this year. And Laura McCarty, president of Georgia Humanities, is telling us a little bit about how the war affected Georgia in particular, both before and after. I'm trying to think about, you know, for all of these young men who are born in Georgia, largely agrarian economy, leaving home for the first time ever to go so, so far away. The emotional impact of that must be tremendous. Do we have records of that kind of thing, Laura?
We certainly have a record of poetry and music from the World War I era. Composers like Stravinsky, whose music is radical, Elgar, who's very elegiac. And poetry, writers that we revere like Ernest Hemingway were involved in World War I, and perhaps one of the most famous poems from that era is John McCrae's In Flanders Field, which inspired another Georgian.
Let's hear Leonard Cohen, of all people, reciting In Flanders Fields, the poem by John McCrae.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
What's the connection between that poem and Georgia?
Towards the end of the war, a woman from Walton County, Georgia, Moena Michael, who also worked as an administrator at the University of Georgia, attended a YMCA convention as a volunteer. She read a magazine, and In Flanders Field was published on that magazine. The image of Flanders Field with the crosses and the poppies made an influence on her. She learned that poppies bloom after the land has been disturbed, and certainly the war had disturbed that land, and it had become a cemetery, but it had also become this field of beautiful flowers. So she began to wear a poppy on her dress, and she began to make poppies and to suggest that those could be sold to raise funds to help veterans and also to provide for the remembrance of the war. And so Moena Michael's idea, it caught on. Other people began to do this. Eventually, the American Legion and the British Legion adopted the poppy as the flower for remembrance, and the veterans of foreign wars also did. So this image of the poppy is certainly one that's associated with World War I, and I think that Georgia connection is important to note this year.
Where else can Georgians go to learn about and remember the state service men and women who supported them during World War I?
To learn more about Georgia in World War I, there is an article in the New Georgia Encyclopedia, which is georgiaencyclopedia.org, by Todd Womack of Douglas, Georgia. And it has lots of additional information about the role of Georgia in World War I, because it was a important part of our state story as well as the American and the world story.
Yeah.
There are some monuments at courthouses and things with lists of names. And so one of the things the commission has tried to do is find additional names that need to be added to that number. Many of the monuments were segregated. We were clearly under Jim Crow at the time of World War I. And so this has been a real opportunity through other kinds of primary sources to recognize the service of all Georgians who were involved in World War I. Dublin, Georgia has actually been in the process of mounting a new marker to add the African-American names and others that were left off the marker from the time period to their marker. So, the next time you're in a little town Courthouse Square, look around. There's probably a World War I marker somewhere there for you to see and learn more about that county's service.
What would you like people to know beyond those names, just that kind of public acknowledgement of those who were lost?
Well, each person's name is a story, and it's relatives. I attended a program down in Nashville, Georgia, in October of 2018, and it marked the 100th anniversary of an event called the Otranto tragedy. The Otranto was a sailing vessel that was in the process of taking some soldiers over to participate in the war. And they really never made it because off the coast of Scotland, there was a bad storm and there was an accident between a couple of the ships and a convoy. And so many of the sailors perished there. At this event in Nashville this past fall, their names were read aloud, and descendants of those people, you know, whether they be great-great nephews or, you know, third-time removed cousins, they were there, and they were the living legacies of those people who, you know, lost their lives on the way to that conflict. It was really a beautiful thing to see the community come together to recognize these people. With every name that's on a marker, there is a story, and that's what those of us that are interested in history try to do, is bring those things forward.
It was a period not just of death overseas, but death here. What did that mean for the spirit and psyche of Americans?
Well, there's a lot of interesting cultural exchange from that time period. People talk about the Jazz Age, and in some ways, the Jazz Age can be associated with African Americans leaving the South and serving in whatever capacity in World War I. The Harlem Renaissance, some of the authors that participated in that, you know, had connections to World War I. If they had not served themselves, their fathers or their cousins or their uncles had. The cultural impact of World War I is also another thing to recall. This is the first war where we had things like machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology
of war changed tremendously.
There's also a connection to that time period of the debates about women's suffrage and, you could say, the very early beginnings of civil rights activism, in that African Americans who served came back and many of them were treated in terrible ways in the South after they returned after rendering a wonderful service. Eugene Bullard, after he was smuggled out of France around the time of the beginning of World War II, ended up in New York, and he was working as an elevator operator in a hotel, and he was really pretty much unknown and unrecognized. However, when he died, the word got back to people in France, and all these French military people came to his funeral, you know, the funeral of this man that the people around him in New York knew as the hotel elevator operator. And so then, you know, many years later, as people have looked back to the Tuskegee Airmen's service, there's also been a recognition that the World War I generation, the service that they rendered, made African Americans convinced that they should be the beneficiaries of other rights that Americans hold dear.
Laura McCarty, president of Georgia Humanities, thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I learned a lot. We have a link to some of the events that are going on across the state and country in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the armistice, and also a link to the New Georgia Encyclopedia, which Laura mentioned. All of that at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, we're going to go much more deeply into how African Americans changed the face of World War I and how the war changed life for African Americans. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This Veterans Day marks 100 years since the end of World War I. The war to end all wars, as it was called, transformed the United States, and that was also true for African Americans. David Davis is professor of English at Mercer University and has written and studied the role of Black Americans in the Great War and its effect on their lives. And he's joining me now from GPB in Macon. David, welcome.
Hi, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's such an interesting subject that I think a lot of people don't necessarily know about. So let's get into it. The U.S. declared war against Germany in April of 1917. So remind us of what it was like being an African American in the South at that time.
It was difficult. It's 20 years after the Plessy v. Ferguson decision. The United States is heavily segregated. Woodrow Wilson is president of the United States. Wilson's a native of the South. And one of his first acts as president was to also segregate the federal government. So this was a time of Jim Crow. And when America declares war, African Americans are very ambivalent about America joining a war in Europe. On one hand, it doesn't seem to have any direct effect on African Americans. But for some African American leaders, the possibility of engaging in a war for democracy on a foreign shore would present an opportunity to make a case for democracy and equality in the United States.
So the war was meant to make the world safe for democracy. And as you mentioned, some African American leaders, like civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, urged African Americans to enlist. Other prominent Black leaders share in Du Bois's message, and did people buy it?
There was a good bit of back and forth on the issue. Some leaders believed that African Americans had no business being involved in a white man's war. Others, however, saw this as an opportunity to make a case for equality. Du Bois at the time was editor of the NAACP magazine, The Crisis, and he, along with the head of the NAACP, Joel Spingarn, worked with the War Department to make the possibility for certain concessions that would make it possible for African Americans to serve in combat roles in the military. And as part of his support, W.B. Du Bois wrote a very influential editorial in The Crisis in which he urged African Americans to forget their long-going grievances and stand shoulder by shoulder with their fellow white Americans in this war effort. He asked them to, in his words, close ranks.
Well, the federal government called for 100% Americanism in the effort, instituted a draft. How did the, let's say, racist politicians in the South and the soldiers feel about standing shoulder to shoulder with men of color?
Southern political leaders were very concerned about the possibility of African Americans serving in combat. Senator Vardaman of Mississippi, in fact, was one of only about half a dozen senators who voted against the U.S. Declaration of War. And he voted against it because he was afraid that African Americans in uniform trained to shoot and kill white people was a much greater threat to the United States than the Germans. Mm. So this was a very complicated issue. However, America does join the war effort, and the U.S. government calls for a total war effort. And it certainly means that African Americans are going to be involved in the war. So the War Department has a difficult time discerning exactly how to use African Americans. And within a couple of months, they come up with a policy. Effectively, Jim Crow fights World War I. There's a plan for a draft that will involve both white and African Americans, but African Americans are going to be drafted into a segregated corps, and the majority of African Americans who serve in World War I work in labor battalions, a unit called the Services of Supply. About 350,000 African Americans serve in the war, and of that number, about 300,000 serve in these labor battalions. These labor battalions are extremely important to the U.S. war effort. The United States is mounting an international war across an ocean on very short notice. So all of the essential work of building camps, loading and unloading ships, building trenches and war materiel, all of that is the credit of African Americans who are serving in labor battalions during the war.
Did African American soldiers see actual combat in addition to those service positions?
They did. There were two divisions of African American soldiers who served in combat during World War I. And they provide a very interesting contrast in the African American war experience. One of these battalions is, one of these divisions is the 92nd. And they serve under American command during the war. And their leadership consistently derails their service in combat. And so their experience is not so glorious. But there's another division, the 93rd, that serves under French command during the war. And they serve with great valor and recognition. They hold their line for a record 191 days. There are no casualties. There are no prisoners. There are no surrenders. And many members of the 93rd were awarded the French Award for Valor, the Croix de Guerre.
What kind of record, beyond that recognition, do we have of the experience of life of an African-American soldier serving in France or overseas?
There are a few stories of African-Americans who served in World War I, and as an English professor, I'm naturally drawn to the literary representation of the war. One of these soldiers is Victor Daley. Victor Daley is originally from New York City. He attends Cornell University. And when the war breaks out, he is among a small number of African-Americans who is trained as an officer at the segregated officer training camp at Fort Des Moines, Iowa. He serves in the war as a member of the 92nd, serves with valor, is awarded the Croix de Guerre. And after the war, he's inspired by his experience to write a story of the war. So he publishes a novel called Not Only War that describes the experience of an African-American soldier from the South who enlists and serves. And the book is really a contrast about the experience of Black soldiers in the United States and France. When this soldier is in the United States South, his life is segregated. He begins a relationship with an African-American woman who is also in a relationship with a white man, which delineates the role of Jim Crow even in romantic relationships. Then he's shipped to France. And in France, he's billeted in the home of a white French woman. And he finds that the relationships between African-American men and white women in France are considered differently than the relationships in the United States. So the book makes a really transgressive case for interracial relationships and transatlantic racial relations in the context of wartime.
You edited a reprint of that book by Victor Daley. How many people who were contemporary readers might have seen something like this, seen his account of what it was like to serve in France in World War I?
The book was actually quite popular at the time it was published. This book comes out in the context of a movement of African-American thought leaders, artists, and intellectuals pushing back against the racial standards of the early 20th century. We often refer to this movement as the New Negro. It's an outgrowth of the NAACP, African-American intellectual experience, and the crucible of the war experience. African-Americans who came home from France, where they had fought either directly or indirectly for democracy, and where they had experienced among the French people a certain level of social equality, genuinely expected to receive equal treatment in the United States. And so in that year after World War I, 1919, we see an outbreak of hostility between African-Americans who are fighting for their rights in the United States and the racialized, segregated white establishment in the United States. There are riots from Chicago to Texas. But this movement doesn't die away after 1919. It continues to gather momentum, and we see an increasing round of oppositionality between African-American leaders and segregation. And this leads, among other things, to the Harlem Renaissance, to a very influential anthology of literature called The New Negro, and an antagonistic paradigm between African-American writers and segregation.
My guest is Mercer University English professor David Davis. He has written a book about the African-American experience in World War I in literature, and we're learning about some of the things that the Black soldiers encountered going into World War I and coming away from it. Well, I want to pick up on that New Negro idea and also to thrive in France, a place outside of the U.S. This is something we know later in the Jazz Age. Artists and writers absolutely embraced in France. And likewise, soldiers. Eugene Jacques Boulard, he's from, actually, I suppose you wouldn't say his name quite so French, because he's from Columbus, Georgia. Eugene Jacques Boulard was the first African-American military pilot French General Charles de Gaulle called him a true French hero, named him a Knight of the French Legion of Honor. So how did the French treat black soldiers during the war, both citizens and army, compared to how they were treated in the U.S.?
African Americans who experienced social equality in France were forever changed by the experience. However, French treatment of African American soldiers was highly problematic for the U.S. War Department. W.E.B. Du Bois collected a number of documents after the war, including a set of orders from the U.S. War Department to their French counterparts, explaining to them how to treat African American soldiers. And it includes rules such as do not look them in the eye, do not salute them, do not speak to them using their military title. So there was an attempt to segregate the experience of African Americans among the French people. However, the French people were not much inclined to follow the U.S. government's regulations. So they tended to treat African American soldiers in the same way they treated all other soldiers who were fighting for their freedom on French soil. So African Americans in the war, they have relationships with French people on equitable terms. They're treated like humans, like men. And that, for people who had spent their entire lives in a system of dehumanizing segregation, was a revolutionary experience.
When soldiers returned, as you said, they'd seen another glimpse of the way that they could be treated. Some actively opposed and protested American-style racism on their return, and tensions really came to a head in the summer of 1919 in what was called the Red Summer. What happened?
So in the Red Summer, there were racial riots across the United States. One of the most famous occurred in Chicago, Illinois, when African-American swimmers made their way across an imaginary line dividing a white-only beach from a black-only beach. This leads to a violent riot that goes on for several days. Also during that summer, there was a racial massacre in Elaine, Arkansas. There are riots in D.C. There are riots in Texas. Altogether, there's about 25 race riots across the country. Now, racial violence in the United States this time is not unusual. In fact, we're talking about a period of time that is the heyday of racial lynchings. But what characterizes the Red Summer is we see in all of these riot instances, African Americans fighting back against white supremacy, sometimes fighting back with arms. And in many cases, we see African Americans who had returned from World War I fighting for their own rights in the United States.
The poet Claude McKay wrote a poem reflecting the increasingly defiant spirit of black Americans. Can you give us a couple of lines from that poem, If We Must Die?
Yes, this is a famous poem that embodies the ethos of the New Negro. The poem reads, "If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back."
There is so much in that poem, the imagery of the soldier returned, and apparently, given that there were so many lynchings in the United States in that time, even African Americans who'd been serving and were lynched in uniform. So what, given that, was the legacy for African American soldiers who fought in World War I?
Mixed at best. To pick up on your example of African Americans who were lynched in uniform, there's one story of a returning soldier named Wilbur Little who returns to Baxley, Georgia. And he's met at the train station while wearing his uniform and told by an angry white mob that if he wears the uniform again, he'll be killed. 2 weeks later, he appears in public in his uniform, and he's lynched while wearing his uniform. He was one of more than a dozen African-American veterans who were lynched after the war, in some cases literally while wearing their uniforms. The message for African-Americans about the war to make the world safe for democracy was mixed. On one hand, it makes the case that democracy, freedom, and equality are causes worth fighting for, in fact, worth dying for. But on the other hand, it makes clear the case that the United States is not going to be a nation that easily or quickly extends social equality to African Americans, that the lingering residue of racism and Jim Crow is going to cloud out immediate opportunities for social equality. I do argue, though, that this generation sets the foundation for what will eventually develop into the civil rights movement. It doesn't bring us quite to the point of nonviolent resistance. Instead, it brings us to the point of violent resistance. But it demonstrates that African Americans will fight, will die for their country and for their race.
David Davis, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Mercer University English professor David Davis. He is also author of the book World War I and Southern Modernism. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get an update on the recovery efforts in southwest Georgia in the wake of Hurricane Michael. Please join us for the show at 9 o'clock on GPB. An organization called Songwriting with Soldiers is trying to help veterans deal with the emotional cost of war. It pairs professional songwriters with veterans to tell combat stories through music. Mary Gaucher has released an entire album of these songs. It's called Rifles and Rosary Beads. Veteran Jamie Trent worked on the track Bullet Holes in the Sky and discussed the story behind it for an upcoming podcast from GPB and The Bitter Southerner.
When I enlisted, I was 18. I really didn't think at the time that I'd spend 9 months on an aircraft carrier with 100 fighter jets where you're right in the middle of essentially a war going on. I really just wanted to get money for college and have a good time, but didn't really know what was attached with that.
It's the 11th of November down in Nashville, Tennessee. Free breakfast at the Waffle House if I show my ID. A parade up on the riverfront, you can hear the trumpets play. Hands on hearts, the color guard kicks it off on Veterans Day.
That's the first verse of the song. And it's actually a true story, at least when I was in the service on Veterans Day, every day on November 11th. What I remember was the Waffle House would give a free breakfast to anybody that showed their ID. And I remember back then, and even more vivid to me today, is that that could be the singular most happy and sad thing all wrapped up in one. There's a lot of mixed emotions when you serve. Just to give you an example, I remember when our ship was coming in from deployment from the 9 months overseas, I got off the ship and my parents' car was parked about 5 minutes away. It was about a mile long walk. And as we were getting close to their vehicle, there were signs in the front yard, people's yards, that said, "Dogs and soldiers, stay off the grass." That struck me pretty hard then.
Well, Jesus said, "Forgive them. They know not what they do." And he's here with me this morning, and his words still ring true. So I hang my head and pray for those we lost and those who remain as the clouds burst.
When people hear this song, I want the takeaway to be that the service was a sacrifice and sometimes the ultimate sacrifice, and it's tough. And folks that haven't served maybe sometimes can't fully appreciate what the service members went through during that time.
And in heaven, shining down on us through bullet holes in the sky.
That was veteran Jamie Trent. Thanks to Sean Powers for producing the segment. Tiny houses are hot right now. The housing trend among Instagrammers, affordable housing advocates, and HGTV's tiny house hunters is now being proposed as a solution for homeless veterans. A Savannah-based nonprofit aims to have 24 residents safely moved into a village of tiny houses by the end of the year. Cindy Murphy-Kelly is executive director of Chatham Savannah Authority for the Homeless. And welcome, Cindy.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So I've seen the plans without a lot of detail, because I know you've put a lot of thought into the best, most efficient, low-cost materials. How big are the houses?
The main homes, and that's 68 of them, are 16 by 8, and the four ADA-compliant units are 18 by 8.
A total of 72, but 24 residents you think can move in by the end of the year?
Yes, that is correct. Two villages of 12.
So I know it's hard to get an accurate count of homeless population in general, but how many homeless veterans do you think are in Savannah?
Well, we actually do an annual count, and we count every one of them. And our most recent count, which was last year, 231 homeless veterans.
Mm. I'm sure you've seen other models for this kind of tiny house for veterans. Where have you looked and what have you seen?
We actually looked at models around the country. There's a charming little book that has a variety of models for people interested in building tiny homes. We also spoke with a board member in Madison, Wisconsin, and they built some small tiny small homes, and we talked with some folks in Eugene, Oregon, and then we did a lot of reading research because there's actually quite a lot out there about the movement and what's the best way to build and how do you think about this.
And Chris Stout is CEO and co-founder of the Veterans Community Project, which launched Homes for the Homeless, tiny homes in the veterans community in Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
So, Chris, your project was in the works for 2 years, but just opened up the door to vets this past January. Why did it take so long?
It took a while because we're a grassroots organization. It was just three vets that started this. We were given a piece of property, and it had no sewer and infrastructure for us to be able to do tiny homes within Kansas City limits. We had to make some compromises, and one of those were it couldn't be on wheels. You know, no septic tanks. We had to be hooked up to city utilities. The homes had to be on foundations, very similar to a traditional house. So it allowed us to build within our small footprint, but, you know, kind of accommodate to a normal home. So we had to bring about 1,799 linear feet of sewer to the property to make it happen.
So a lot of hoops to jump through. How much did the units end up costing per unit?
So just through our partnerships and, you know, community support, our actual cost to build them is well under $5,000.
Wow, that's pretty efficient. So I'm wondering, you know, Chris and you, Cindy, you said you've done a lot of research on this. Why tiny homes instead of converting old buildings, schools, you know, buildings that aren't in use anymore for veterans?
So that was our first thought. We headed down that path. Tiny homes were kind of a second idea. One of our board members had suggested it after we approached the city to give us one of their empty schools, because Kansas City has 26 empty schools here. You know, that being said, when we looked at it from an operational standpoint, the cost, it just wasn't cost effective to repurpose a building like that. The other piece was, is out of the three of us that started this, we were working with vets every day. I mean, we're out there on the street doing outreach and engaging them. And they posed a question to us that was very relevant. Well, what's the difference between a building like that and the current shelters that are out there? You know, you still have your communal living situation, communal shower, that kind of stuff. You're not kind of giving them that opportunity to have that safety and that security and all of that stuff that they desire, and kind of removing those barriers to get them off the street. So for us, tiny houses were the option.
Cindy, what was the decision? What was behind that decision for your organization?
Actually, our decision was very similar. It was a very cost-effective model, and we utilize a housing-first approach, and we really wanted our residents to have a place where they can actually go and shut the door and use their own bathroom and cook in their own kitchen, and we felt that that independence and the permanence of the housing was critical. We also are hooked up to city sewer and water, and we have a big infrastructure bill that's actually contributed to the cost. But overall, it's a very affordable option, and we live in a community with a major affordable housing crisis.
Has there been any resistance inside of the community about having effectively a settlement of people who had been homeless right next door?
Yes. We actually found land two times before we settled on a third plot. Because initially we were going to do a small project of only 10 units in a neighborhood, and we had a lot of NIMBY, and so we made the decision to look for land that was a little bit more out of the way, still in the city, but our land is between a horse stable and public housing, and it also is a much larger piece of land than we had originally intended. So our little $200,000 10-unit project grew to $1.7 million.
Wow.
When you add the purchase of the land, 72 units, three clubhouses, and all the infrastructure.
Yeah, it's an expensive city to live in, as it is. We're talking about the development of tiny house villages with Cindy Murphy Kelly. She's executive director of the Chatham Savannah Authority for the Homeless, behind a project, the Tiny House Project in East Savannah. Chris Stout is also with us. He spearheaded a development of tiny homes for homeless veterans in Kansas City, Missouri. So a lot of homeless people stay away from shelters because of the security concerns, because there's often conflict or you're afraid of your stuff getting stolen. But there are also rules. You can't use drugs. You can't use alcohol. Of course, from your perspective, there are safety concerns. So are there rules for living inside of these villages?
We are a housing first project, and the rules are very limited in that we don't allow an open flame in the units just to protect the units overall, and we are a harm reduction model approach. And so we strongly believe that folks need to be stabilized before they can work on their issues or focus on quality of life. And as long as our local officers aren't upset with what's happening, we are pretty open to the lifestyle that our folks choose to lead. And we also really think it's important to treat folks as adults. Mm-hmm. We know some of our folks have challenges, but again, it's really important to work with folks when they're ready.
Yeah, from what I understand, especially among homeless veterans, what really helps is, you know, kind of 360-degree wraparound care, not just housing, but in many cases for PTSD or other ailments or medical ailments, treatment, active treatment. Is that something you can offer? Or let's ask you, Chris, you've been doing this for a while. Is that just one piece?
Yeah. So for us, you know, the tiny houses are kind of like, that's a shiny penny. That's the bait and switch for us, right? We get them in with that, and then the meat and potatoes of what we do is everything else. It's the group and the individual therapy. It is sending them to substance abuse treatment so that they can get taken care of. And to your earlier question, you know, we started out very similar. We're like, hey, listen, they're adults. They're going to, you know, we want to treat them as such. As long as they're progressing and moving towards permanent housing, you know, they're welcome to stay. However, what we found was, you know, veteran A, you know, their behavior was affecting veteran B. So I'm like, listen, we didn't stop the drinking altogether, but we said, listen, it couldn't be on the property. So we had to make some adjustments early on.
Cindy, how about you? What kind of services are you going to be able to offer in addition to providing housing?
We do have a wide range of wraparound services available. We are a direct service provider, and we are the lead agency for homeless services in our community. So we have many collaborative partners, and so we offer a wide range of services, and we have the capacity to build additional services as they are needed. Most recently, we've developed a street medicine program, and the Tiny House Village will be one stop on that program. So we are also a learning nonprofit agency, and as was mentioned, we know that we will have to adjust as we learn. But currently, we're also managing 54 units of scattered site housing, so we have some seasoning with respect to working with formerly homeless folks. And we know that even with best intentions, sometimes we have to adjust what we're doing to make it a fit for all the residents.
Yeah, that can be a pretty big psychological jump for somebody, can't it, to have been on the street for a while and suddenly there's housing. I've actually heard of some people who have not been able to really cope with that.
And we do anticipate that some folks will not be able to already with veterans that we work with in our 22 homeless camps and our emergency shelters. We have a couple of those veterans that we have housed, and in one case, one individual twice. And this particular veteran is simply unable due to PTSD and other issues to maintain the housing. So our primary goal is to keep folks in housing, but we know for some it's going to really be a challenge.
And Cindy Murphy Kelly, the settlement in East Savannah, is that open only to veterans?
It is. The donors that have provided all the support for the project, private donors, businesses, no government money at this point, it is restricted to serving homeless veterans.
Chris, I'm thinking that you watched as veterans moved into, formerly homeless veterans moved into these tiny houses in Kansas City. What was that like to watch them take up residence?
Well, so we're a very small project here. So we started building those homes, those first 13 homes we have, we started those on Christmas Eve. And we completed those in about 31 days. And so when I say we, I mean we, the founders, like the three of us that started this, were out there till about 2 a.m. every day. So for us, on January 31st, when we had that big ribbon cutting thing, and we actually were able to invite the vets in to see the homes for the first time, you know, and the looks on their faces, you know, because a lot of these guys came straight out of the shelters or were in their cars. And for me, it just, man, it made all that work worthwhile, you know, because, you know, we spent the last two and a half years working about 100 hours a week, you know, putting together houses and raising money and, you know, kind of making this happen for these guys. And to have the most grateful, you know, humble group of people moving into these homes. It was absolutely worth every bit of it.
Chris Stout, CEO and co-founder of the Veterans Community Project in Kansas City, thank you.
Thank you.
And Cindy Murphy Kelly, she's executive director of the Chatham Savannah Authority for the Homeless. It's the nonprofit that is creating tiny homes for homeless veterans in Savannah. Cindy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on the project, go to gpbnews.org. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. You can join the conversation with questions or comments. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.